I guess we're open to questions and answers, or maybe at least questions, maybe not answers.
I've heard one thing that the like the Ten Commandments. So I said that they're more important than other mitzvahs, but that they are kolel. They include each mitzvah is like a theme. There's like 10 themes in the 613 mitzvot. And each one is kind of like a claw in the 613. So I was thinking through maybe explain that more and maybe some of the more difficult ones like what would like keeping up the Ein be or what would Shabbos be or what would.
Well, the thing is, that obviously we have a certain ambivalence here. The Gemara in Brachos tells us that in the Beis Hamikdash, the Kohanim used to read the Aseres HaDibros publicly every day. They would recite them every day. And there was a thought to make that a requirement of the synagogue service, that in Shul we should say the Aseres HaDibros every day. But the Gemara quotes a Braisa that says that they were mevatel such a minhag, because people would say, as people do say, that the Ten Commandments are the only important part of the Torah, and the rest of the Torah is not important. So the Chachamim wanted to go out of their way not to give the Aseres HaDibros any prominence or any chashivas beyond the rest of the Torah. This is what the Gemara tells us. Now, by the way, you may ask a question, but I look at a sitter, and the Arshkol sitter, I think, may have the Aseres HaDibros. So b'yechidus, you're allowed to read them, but they're not read b'tzibur. Ad kidei kach, that there's a tshuva of the Rambam, which is not in the Mishnah Torah, where the Rambam was against the minhag of standing up. We stand up when we read the Aseres HaDibros, and the Rambam says that's wrong, because that would be giving the Aseres HaDibros more of a chashivas than the rest of the Torah. Now, he doesn't codify that in the Mishnah Torah. Rav Moshe has a tshuva that as long as you stand up a few psukim before and a few psukim afterwards, that's going to be okay. But still, you always find the common attitude that a Jew always says, well, Rabbi, I'm not so religious, but I keep the Ten Commandments. I know Rabbi Feldman of Atlanta, Rabbi Feldman Sr., who actually lives here now, he tells the story that he had a certain woman that used to come in every afternoon and bother him, just schmooze, and he wasn't always in the mood for schmoozing. So every day she had the same line. She would say, Rabbi, I'm not so religious, but I keep the Ten Commandments. And most of the time he would nod or smile. So one day he was a little irritated. So he said, oh yeah, what about the fourth one? So she said, what's the fourth one? So he said, keep Shabbos. He says, oh, are you sure it's there? So even when people say they keep the Ten Commandments, it often is not the Ten Commandments. So on one hand, we have maybe it's some of the last five. It's really the three commandments. Don't kill, don't commit adultery, maybe they keep three out of the ten. But here's the thing. So on one hand, the Chachamim say, Aseres HaDibros, same as the whole Torah. And yet, one cannot deny that the only time when HaKadosh Baruch Hu appeared to 3 million Jews, he did not give the whole Torah in front of 3 million people. The vast majority of the Torah was a private revelation to Moshe Rabbeinu. And Moshe Rabbeinu told us, the only part of the Torah that we all heard is the Aseres HaDibros. So how is it shaykh to say it's less important? So because of this, the Rishonim developed the idea, which is based on the Medrash, this is a long introduction, that the Aseres HaDibros are not just 10 commandments, but they do represent 10 categories in which we subsume the 613 mitzvahs of the Torah. In point of fact, this is an outline. The Jewish people got through the Aseres HaDibros 613 commandments, which were then spelled out. The Ramban has a little sefer that he wrote in which he actually shows, you can actually get this, he actually shows how each of the commandments is a generalization for many, many mitzvahs. So he'll show the first commandment includes 30 things, and the second commandment includes many, many things. In addition to his Perush al Torah, the Ramban has what is called Kitzvei Ramban, miscellaneous writings, some of which have been translated, and one of his miscellaneous writings is how the Taryag Mitzvos are Merumas in the Aseres HaDibros. And that, as you pointed out in your question, that is the only way we can make sense of the fact that on one hand, Chazal say the Aseres HaDibros are no more important than the rest of the Torah, and on the other hand, they are the only part of the Torah that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave to all of Am Yisrael Begilei Shechita. Truth is, we didn't get all 10. We were going to get all 10, right after the first two. We asked Moshe Rabbeinu to be the intermediary. So truth is, we did not even hear all 10 in that way. So to go through all of them, it was very difficult. But for example, the idea that I am Hashem who took you out of Mitzrayim, so that creates the obligation to revere Hashem, to love Hashem, to walk in His ways, meaning there are a lot of outgrowths of the fact that Hashem was mativ to me, and Hashem punished the Egyptians. That's both Midas Harachamim and Midas Hadin, and that brings in Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem, something like Shabbos, which reminds me that Hashem is the ultimate creator of the world, is connected to the idea of not being arrogant, etc. So he goes through, he goes through each one. Not stealing refers to all of Cheshen Mishpat, all of the laws of property, all of the laws of not damaging, right? All of the laws of not taking things that are not yours, and that can include misrepresentation, Geneva Stas, Ona is overcharging people, right? You can take 30 mitzvos dealing with mumminess, and all of them are outgrowths of not stealing. Not committing adultery means using the Yetzer Hara for arayas in only a proper way with kedushin and the like. So these are our generic categories. I'll check if the Ramban's Kuntres was ever translated into English. I know that Rabbi Chevelle, Olav HaShalom, who's a Rav who translated much of the Ramban's writings, translated some of these too, but I don't know if he translated this. But either way, you can find in a Hebrew set two volumes called Kitzvei HaRamban. So, the library must have it somewhere here in the mysterious caverns of Orson Meir's libraries. You can find Kitzvei HaRamban. It's up here? Okay. All right. So even in you have it in the center, Mamish. So you can check it out and see. It's not very big. It's around 10 pages. Yeah.
I'm wondering then, what exactly is the difference between the instance of God actually speaking in the Torah, because in the beginning, every time God spoke, as Deborah Bria is like, He created something, and so I'm wondering, like, if maybe in when He spoke at Sinai, that was the instance of bringing the Torah into this world, because like every time God spoke, not inside a person's head or in a dream or something, it was always in the form of a creation. So like, what was created when He spoke?
Well, actually, the Torah actually says what was created when God spoke was the emuna in the truth of Moshe Rabbeinu's Nebuah. It's very, very interesting. Which means although Moshe Rabbeinu took us out of Egypt and Moshe Rabbeinu did the 10 plagues and everything else, but the Torah itself says that when they hear the revelation at Sinai and they hear that I'm speaking through you as well, they will believe in your Nebuah for eternity. So really, it created within the heart and soul of the Jew the receptivity to the Nebuah of Moshe Rabbeinu.
Is that on the same level as like creation of everything else?
Well, yes, it is, because it was only the Nebuah of Moshe Rabbeinu that enabled the Jewish people to accept the rest of the Torah. It's funny, everyone, in our Semech especially, we always talk about, Gadli talks about it a lot, the Kuzari principle that from Yehuda Levi, that the accuracy or the fact that Torah is min haShemayim is proven from the fact that we don't claim Hashem just appeared to some isolated people. Because if I say Hashem appeared to me, I might convince you, and that could spread to millions of people, that millions of people believe Hashem appeared to me. Okay? And you could fool people that way. But a claim that Hashem appeared to all of us, how do you create that lie? How do you fool people? If I go over to you and I say Hashem appeared to me, I might convince you to believe me. But if I say Hashem appeared to you, how does that take? But the point is, without denying the validity of the Kuzari principle, one has to remember that the vast majority of the Torah is exactly a private revelation. Moshe Rabbeinu says to us, Hashem appeared to me and told me that this is what you should do. At that point, lahavdil, a million gazillion havdalos, Moshe is like Jesus, meaning to say, Jesus says, God appears to me, trust me. So the question becomes, if Judaism rises and falls on mass revelation, then why do I trust Moshe Rabbeinu? The answer is, that is what the mass revelation of Har Sinai did. The mass revelation of Har Sinai did not only communicate specific commandments, 10 of them, but it communicated the sense that we saw from this mass revelation that Hashem says, Moshe Rabbeinu is the one that's going to give me the Torah. That is, now to say, this created the Torah, that I think would be difficult, because as you know, Chazal actually teach, it's a reverse cause and effect, that the Torah preceded the creation of the world, and the Torah was the blueprint out of which Hashem created the world. The Torah was the DNA of the universe. So if anything, it is not the later event of Matan Torah that created Torah.
Brought it down from Shemaim.
Okay, well that's very true. That's very true. That indeed brought it down. That's an interesting way of putting it. That the mimer of Matan Torah, in effect, brought Torah into the world.
So then was it impossible for Klal Yisrael to accept the Torah without that then? It seemed like because of that they didn't accept the Torah, because then it would have been impossible for them to accept it otherwise?
Well, perhaps so, because you had to take what was purely heavenly and it had to be made part and parcel of this earth in order for human beings to be able to accept it. So that could be part of the necessary process. But Hashem used the Ten Commandments as the way of creating that process because they encapsulate the whole Torah. By the way, there's a chaver of mine from Yeshiva many, many years ago. He wrote a book around 30 years ago. And it never got a lot of attention. Now someone is trying to update it or revise it, in which he had a very, very interesting theory. He had a very interesting understanding of the structure of the Torah. And he tried to go through the whole Torah this way, in which he claimed that you have to line up the Aseres Hadibros in two columns of five. And this part is not his Kiddush. The first five are man-God, and the second five are man-man. That's a well-known idea. But his idea was you have to match them, meaning number one has a similar principle to number six. Number two matches up with number seven. Okay? In other words, there's like the principle carries out in both Bein Adam Lamakom and Bein Adam L'Chaveiro. He then wanted to show that each Chumash is devoted to one of those principles. So Chumash Bereishis is principle one and six. Chumash Shmos is principle 2 and 7. Chumash Vayikra is principle 3 and 8. He then went further to show that although each Chumash is dominantly a fundamental principle, each of the other principles are echoed in minor key throughout the Chumashim. So eventually, he looks at the Aseres Hadibros as permeating the entire structure of Chumash. So although Bereishis is the 1-2 principle, but in minor chord, you have the 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Shmos is the 2, 4 principle, but in minor chord. He was doing this to try to explain the phenomenon of Ein Mukdam HaMukher B'Torah. The Torah often does not follow chronological order. And even in halachas, there's often juxtapositions that appear to be random, like why is meat and milk, you know, after Bikurim? You just have a list of halachas. We can't even figure out what is the sense of the order. So he developed a whole theory about this. Now, in detail, he only worked out Chumash Bereishis, but there's a fellow in Chicago who now did a Shmos Vayikra Bamidbar Devarim. He asked me to write an introduction for him, so that's why I'm familiar with the book. So in around a year or so, or maybe less, maybe 6 months or so, look for this book. The author is Appleson. And it'll be an amplification of this. So according to this, the Aseres Hadibros are the structure of Kol HaTorah Kula, not just the Aseres Hadibros. They are the basis of everything as reflected in the five principles. Yeah.
I was wondering if the Rav could clarify for us the Nitziv's position on Zionism.
Well, the Nitziv was a very interesting person. I think I had occasion to mention, I mentioned him the other day that he denied that something was written by the Vilna Gaon. The Nitziv, again, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, was the Rosh Yeshiva of the world-famous Volozhin Yeshiva. This was the yeshiva that was founded by Rav Chaim of Volozhin, who was the Vilna Gaon's greatest Talmud. One has to understand it was not just a yeshiva. It really was now, of course, we've had yeshivas since Avraham Avinu, but this is the first modern yeshiva. I don't mean modern in the sense of being modern, but the whole yeshiva system, shiurim, gradations, a Rosh Yeshiva. You know, it used to be before this, most yeshivas were private places. You would sit in the Beis Medrash. People would just sit and learn. And, you know, they would ask a Rebbe a question or something. There was not an organized structure of shiurim. And certainly most yeshivas were local, meaning, you know, in Vilna they had this, and other cities they had this. Voloshin was an international yeshiva that attracted students from all over Europe, even a few Americans. And it was a structured yeshiva, and it was an elitist yeshiva, in the sense that to get into Voloshin you had to be pretty smart. Lahavdil, it was like the Harvard or the Ivy League of yeshivas. You know, regular people, you know, could not get to Voloshin. Everybody in Voloshin was very smart. By the way, that was part of its downfall as well, because many of the students of Voloshin gravitated to the Haskalah or whatever it is. They may have left the Derech HaTorah precisely because of a certain intellectual arrogance that existed among some segments of Voloshin. But the Voloshin lasted for 90 years. But for around 50 of those years, most of its tenure, 50 of the 90 years, the head Rosh Yeshiva of Voloshin was Rav Naftal Yehuda Berlin, who was married to Rav Chaim of Voloshin's granddaughter. So he was in the Mishpacha. The Netziv was a great, great Gadol B'Torah. In fact, some people have said, although it's hard to imagine because I know other Gadolim who came afterwards, that the Netziv was the last Gadol who knew Kol HaTorah Kula. He knew everything in Torah. Many Gadolim specialize. They know one thing, not another thing, even if it means you know Shas and Shulchan Aruch, which is huge. That's not Kol HaTorah Kula. The Netziv was Midrashim and Agadata and Kabbalah and Diktuk and Tanakh. The Netziv was like a true person who knew Kol HaTorah Kula, and as a result, he was involved in things that most Rosh Hashivas were not involved in. Tanakh, Diktuk, as I mentioned, he was a great, great expert in. That is not a common specialty among the people who sit and learn in the yeshiva cycle. Now, the Netziv's assistant, Rosh Hashiva, was the great Rav Chaim of Brisk, who later became the Rav of Brisk, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. And they had very, very different drachim in learning. The Netziv's derech, because the Netziv had unparalleled knowledge of Kol HaTorah Kula, the Netziv's derech of shiurim tended to be based on a Bakiyas type of learning in which he would bring in. Now, I don't mean Bakiyas like our fast Gemara in Rashi. I don't mean that. I mean a Bakiyas of all the Rishonim and all the Achronim, but he would bring in many, many different things. Rav Chaim's derech was based on profound analytical depth. He didn't necessarily bring in a lot of commentaries. He would just look at the Rambam or look at the Tosfos and analyze things in great, great depth. They were two great Rosh Hashivas. Again, the Netziv was the head, Rav Chaim was the assistant. But it's very interesting to know that although they had different styles in learning, and in fact, Rav Chaim married the Netziv's granddaughter, so they were related by family as well, they were very different in a lot of ways. They were very close. In fact, they're buried next to each other in Warsaw. Why in Warsaw? I mean, neither of them lived in Warsaw. The reason is that Warsaw, Poland was, at least for that part of Europe, the best medical center at the time. So a lot of Gedolim were buried in Warsaw because they went to Warsaw for medical treatment, and when that didn't work, they died. So the Warsaw Cemetery, next to the Mount of Olives, is the largest Jewish cemetery in the world. You know, like 2 million. This has nothing to do with the Holocaust. The Nazis didn't use that cemetery. But, you know, Rabbi Tzvi, all sorts of people are buried there. And it's really amazing because Warsaw had all sorts of Jews. Warsaw had the great Tzaddikim of Chaim the Netziv. And then they have the founder of Esperanto, that is a big monument. And then they have an actress. I visited the Warsaw Cemetery around 3 years ago. And it's really a very, very strange thing. On one hand, they have Gedolei Olam. And then they have this actress of the Yiddish theater, who has a big, gaudy monument, like a statue and a thing. That's all like side by side. It's all in the same cemetery. And it's the founder of Esperanto. All sorts of people are buried in the Warsaw Cemetery. But in addition to their difference in learning, which sometimes created tension, they had a difference in a lot of hashgafas, and that is the Netziv by temperament was a very, very gentle person, and the Netziv was not a zealous person, meaning he was willing to accept many, many different types of ideas that he would work with. So, for example, the Netziv had very good relationships with maskilim. The maskilim were so-called enlightened ones. These were Jews that were involved in secular literature and science. Some of them were from, not all Maskilim were not religious. Some Maskilim were religious Maskilim, who believed in secular science and education. Other Maskilim left the Derech. But the Nitziv had a relationship with all of them. And in addition, because the Nitziv was a great, great lover of Eretz Yisrael, the Nitziv was willing to have a relationship with the beginnings of the Zionist movement. Now, at the very beginning of the Zionist movement, this is the organized attempt to bring Jews back to the land of Israel. This was in the middle of the 19th century. There were people like Theodor Herzl, who is considered to be the founder of modern political Zionism, who was totally non-religious. I'm not going to say Herzl was anti-religious, because we can still debate that. But Herzl was so ignorant of Judaism that he just didn't know anything. So it's hard to say that Herzl was directly anti-religious, but Herzl attracted religious, formerly religious Jews who were anti-religious, and they became part of Herzl's idea. By the way, many simple Jews in Europe, you know, they didn't know all these religious, not religious. They see Herzl with a big black beard. You've seen a picture of Herzl. Herzl looks like an Orthodox rabbi, and many Jews thought Herzl was Mashiach. There were Jews who thought Herzl was he would bring us back to the land of Israel. So he was regarded as a messianic figure in some circles. But so the Nitziv had a connection. He had a positive connection with Zionist leaders, both religious Zionist leaders and not religious Zionist leaders, because his hashkafa was that we can work even with non-religious Jews if we are working to positive and constructive ends. And building up the land of Israel, buying land for farms, encouraging agriculture, encouraging industry, encouraging Jews to move in, the Nitziv says that is a good goal. And if that is a good goal, we can work with all Jews that are trying to achieve that goal, and we don't have to be so machmir how religious they are. Now, did the Nitziv believe in non-religious Zionism? No, he fundamentally did not believe in it. But he saw that each person is doing their contribution. So non-religious Zionists are doing a mitzvah as well of building up the land of Israel. So the Nitziv did have what we might say a friendly relationship with all sorts of segments. And Bichlal, the Nitziv's derech was never to criticize or condemn or to be mevatel anybody, because he also saw that by kindness and consideration and working with people who are not religious on common projects, you can actually create a Kiddush Hashem and bring them over to Torah. Let me just say that the person who actually lived in Eretz Yisrael, who exemplified the Nitziv's teachings to the greatest extent, was Rav Avraham Yitzchak Cohen Cook, Rav Cook, who, this was exactly his hashkafa, and let me just remind you, if you don't know, that Rav Cook was a Talmud of the Nitziv in Volozhin, and there's absolutely no question that the Nitziv had an enormous influence on Rav Cook. Rav Cook went a little further than maybe the Nitziv would have gone, but the seeds of Rav Cook's machshava were planted by the Nitziv. Now, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik had a very, very different personality. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, who of course is the ancestor of the Briskers who live in Eretz Yisrael, was on a personal level extremely kind, unusually kind. I mean, he spoke to everyone. Little children used to love to talk to him. It's hard for us to realize because we look at Rav Chaim as the great, profound thinker. And you would think it'd be a little scary to talk to him. But actually, it's the way people describe it, it was not that way at all. He was the absolutely most approachable, although he was indeed a genius of phenomenal depth and a tremendous masmid who taught in learning basically 24 hours a day. But there was no person who was more approachable than him. Children would approach him, and goyim would approach him. He talked to everybody, and he made everyone feel good. So on a personal level, he was extremely approachable. But ideologically, he was very, very firm. He believed that Zionists who did not accept the Torah were sinners, and because they were sinners, we cannot do anything with them. If we do things with them, we are working with Rishayim. And he considered political Zionism to be equivalent to Avodah Zarah, because you are substituting nationalism for belief in God, and you are attributing Kochi V'Otzem Yadi, that it's my strength that gives me victory. So as a result, he uncompromisingly refused to have anything to do with Zionism. Of course, keep in mind, he and the Nitziv are in the same yeshiva, right? I mean, so they're both Russian yeshivas. Like, what do you do? You know, if you had one Russian yeshiva this way, wonders yeshiva this way. Ad kidei kach, that Rav Chaim considered to be, well, he would call Talmidim in, and if he was aware of any Zionist activity, he would expel the Talmud immediately. Sometimes the Talmud would appeal to the Nitziv, and sometimes the Nitziv kind of regretfully didn't want a second, you know, didn't want to second guess another Rosh Hashiva, so the Nitziv had to live with it, etc. So there were different issues like that. So they were very, very different personalities, and the kana'us, the zealousness of Brisk, ad hayom hazeh, the Briskers are very extreme anti-Zionists. Brisks are really a group within the Tureh Karta. There cannot be a state of Israel. comes from Rav Chaim, not the Brisker Rav. The Brisker Rav, his son, was the first Soloveitchik to live in Eretz Yisrael. Rav Chaim never came to, never got to Eretz Yisrael, but the hashgafa about this was Rav Chaim's hashgafa. Rav Chaim considered political Zionism, even with, now, by the way, Rav Chaim was not only, and I want to correct myself, Rav Chaim was not only against non-religious Zionists, Rav Chaim was against religious Zionists, because he felt the whole idea of Zionism was equating nationalism with Torah. And that was a fundamental mistake. That's what Rav Chaim said. Another very big difference of opinion that they had, this is a bit controversial out of Yom HaZeh, is the attitude towards secular studies. There are many indications that although the Nitziv was a tremendous masmid, we learned Yom HaVelayla, but the Nitziv saw a role within a yeshiva structure for a certain amount of secular education, to learn Russian, mathematics, and the like. Rav Chaim was absolutely against it. Rav Chaim would not allow anything in. Now, this is connected to a story that has entered the annals of the yeshiva world, and there's a lot of controversy. It was a true story. The fact that we do know is, we know that the Volozhiner Yeshiva was closed. The world-famous Volozhiner Yeshiva was closed in the late 19th century, in the 1890s. I don't remember the exact date. The Nitziv was so heartbroken that the Nitziv died a few months afterwards. Rav Chaim lived for almost 20 years after, but the Nitziv died almost immediately after the yeshiva was closed. Why was the yeshiva closed? Because Tsarist Russia demanded that the yeshiva introduce secular studies and become an accredited school. So they could have kept the yeshiva open if they would have introduced secular education. Rav Chaim and the Nitziv made the decision. They will not maintain the yeshiva under those conditions. That will adulterate Torah, that will corrupt Torah, that will pollute Torah. Close it up and let people learn by themselves. Now, in the Olam HaYeshivos, this story is recounted as the idea, especially in Eretz Yisrael, you cannot bring in any secular influences in a yeshiva. You see that Rav Chaim and the Nitziv closed down the yeshiva instead of allowing secular studies, right? That's how the Welt touches up that story. So let me give you a counter version of the story. Many of you might be familiar with the Sefer Torah Tamima, and if you're not, it's a good Sefer to be familiar with. Torah Tamima is on Chumash, and the author of the Torah Tamima gathers all of the Gemaras on every Pasuk of Chumash together with the commentaries. So if you want to know, what do Chazal say about whatever it is, about Eisha Shefas Torah? So pull out your Torah Tamima on Chumash Devarim, it'll give you all of the Gemaras, and it'll even give you an explanation of the ones. It's a very, very beautiful Sefer, Torah Tamima. He did this on the Chumash and on the five Megillahs. He didn't do it on the rest of Tanakh. Who is the Torah Tamima? So the Torah Tamima was an interesting person. He was the son of the Aruch HaShulchan, who was one of the great Gedolei HaPoskim. He happened to be the nephew of the Nitziv, because the Aruch HaShulchan and the Nitziv were brothers-in-law. They married sisters. So the Torah Tamima, in addition to his Torah Tamima, he actually wrote a four-volume biography or autobiography of his life and the people that he knew. He learned in Volozhin, and he was very close to the Nitziv. He was a teenager in Volozhin, and he was the Nitziv secretary in the afternoon. He used to write letters, mail things for the Nitziv. So in part four of his Sefer Makor Baruch, he actually talks about the Nitziv, the Volozhin Yeshiva, and why the Nitziv closed down the Volozhiner Yeshiva. And he says that the Russian government demanded, this is what the Russian government demanded, that yeshiva learning only take place until 1 o'clock in the afternoon, that the rest of the day be devoted to secular studies, and that the school be closed at night. Now, this was a pretext. They made up a Baba Maaseh for health reasons. We have to close the facility at 7 p.m. because students need 8 hours of study. You know, whatever it is, it was a made-up thing. It was obviously an anti-Semitic decree. So keep in mind that it's not like, oh, they wanted 1 hour of secular studies a day. They wanted 6 hours of secular studies a day, and they didn't want a night seder. So the Torah Tumimah says, that's why the Nitzav closed down Balazsa, not because he was against a little bit of secular studies. And in fact, the Torah Tumimah says the Nitziv was willing to introduce up to an hour or 2 hours a day of Chachmas Chitzonis. This is what the Makar Baruch says, and he was there. He was in the yeshiva at the time. He was a student at the yeshiva. He was close to the Nitziv. Now, I remember this part of the Makar Baruch was translated by somebody around 25 years ago, and the Lakewood Cheder was trying to raise money, so they mailed this out. I remember this like yesterday. And around 3 weeks after we received this book as a fundraiser, we get a letter from the Lakewood Cheder saying, please return this book, we'll give you a full refund. It has come to our attention that this book contains ideas that are not in accordance with Das Torah. Now, of course, when you get a letter like that, you're going to read the book. I mean, even if you didn't read the book, what on earth is in that book that is so controversial that they have to, you know, ask for it back and they'll give you your money back? The answer is it was exactly this nekuda, that the Torah Tumimah intimated that the Nitziv was not against some secular studies as long as it would be a small part of the day and the majority of the day and the night would be devoted to Limud HaTorah. That goes keneged the Messiah that the yeshiva world has. Now, I will tell you that this is still not a clear issue because the Nitziv had two sons. One son was Rav Chaim Berlin, the yeshiva in New York is named after him, Rav Chaim Berlin, who came to Yerushalayim, and he was very, very Haredi, Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld. The other son was Rav Meir Berlin, who was a great, great religious Zionist, and he changed his name to Rabbi Meir Bar Ilan, the founder of Bar Ilan University. Now, again, Rav Meir Bar Ilan was a big Talmud Chacham. I'm not going to sit here and say anything bad about him in particular, but they had two different orientations. Rav Chaim Berlin was a Haredi connected to Rav Yeshua Leib Diskin and Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld. Rav Meir Bar Ilan was a great, great Zionist. And Rav Chaim Berlin took the position that his father had told him on his father's deathbed, the Nitziv had said on his deathbed, close the yeshiva down, you close the yeshiva before you have secular study. So on one hand we have the Torah Tumimah and Rav Meir Bar Ilan's accounts of it, and then we have Rav Chaim Berlin. So what the Nitziv's motivations were not clear. But I will tell you this. We may have ambiguity about the Nitziv. We don't have ambiguity about Rav Chaim. In other words, maybe that's the confusion. Rav Chaim would have closed it down for any secular studies. So it could be Eilu Eilu Divrei Elokim Chaim, that the chiluk, whether it was closed down because of the excessive study or to be closed down because of any secular study, might have been the two dais of the Nitziv and Rav Chaim, because they did have different versions. Now, you may ask at this, if you're familiar with YU, Q University, so you know that the guiding gadol of YU for most of its years was a great rabbi who died already more than 20 years ago, Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. Right? You've heard of he's called the Rav by his Talmidim. And Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik is a grandson of Rav Chaim. So you may wonder, number one, Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik had a doctorate in philosophy from the University of Berlin. He devoted his life to an institution that stresses the idea of combining Torah and secular studies. How could this be a grandson of Rav Chaim? Rav Chaim was absolutely against any type of secular study. And of course, Rav Chaim's son, the Brisker Rav, had that same shita. Rav Yosher Ber comes from another son of Rav Chaim, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. So the answer is, the culprit, that's not the appropriate word of using, is that Rav Chaim's other son, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, did depart from his father's shittas in some way, and he endorsed both Zionism and a certain amount of secular study. So Rav Yosher Ber kind of comes from the Rav Moshe Soloveitchik strand. The Briskers in Eretz Yisrael come from Rav Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik strand. So Rav Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik has all of the zealousness of Rav Chaim. The Rav Moshe Soloveitchik was a more moderate group. So they're different shitas. The paradox is, the Briskers who are Zionists live in America, and the Briskers who are anti-Zionists live in Eretz Yisrael. So the Zionist Briskers all live in America. That's from Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, Rav Yosef Do Soloveitchik. They are the sons of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. Okay, it's kind of a long answer, but again, it's good to get a sense of who the players are, who the actors are in this important, in these various issues. But be it as it may, the Netziv, both philosophically and emotionally, would not condemn people. So on one hand, he actually was sympathetic to the aims of Zionism. On the other hand, his nature was, even if he wasn't sympathetic, he would not shout, he would not put people in chayrim. He believed that that is not the way you reach people. Again, you see, so when you learn about Rav Kook, you see so much of the Netziv reflected in Rav Kook. Yeah, that's a very good question. In fact, you know, all of us say that the last three brachos of Shemona Esrei are said to be thanksgiving. In fact, two of the three are not. okay, so we have Ritzei. We ask Hashem, accept our divine service. That's asking Hashem for something. Then we have Modin, thank you. Okay, that's one. Then we ask Hashem for peace. So two out of the three that are supposed to be thanksgiving blessings are not even thanksgiving. But I would say this, it is a very good question, and the Jerusalem are not so great. We don't have so many good Jerusalem on this. But it would seem the following, that in order for a person to be grateful, a person has to be calm enough to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu's greatness. Meaning to say, when you are in a state of turbulence, confusion, tension, anxiety, you're not able to be thankful even for the chasadim that Hashem gives you. So essentially, you can look at Sim Shalom as not simply a prayer for peace, but a prayer that Hashem give us the conditions that will enable us to be grateful. Meaning, we so much want to feel gratitude, but when we live in a world of wars and strife and turbulence, we can't even relax enough to see your infinite chesed. So Sim Shalom could be regarded as part of a Hodah, because we're asking Hashem to give us the ability to be grateful. That requires that our environment be more serene. That might be one approach for that.
Yeah. I've noticed that when people cut their finger, it's the sort of thing that people do is they put their finger in their mouth. So I was wondering, the prohibition against consuming blood, does it apply to your own blood?
Yes, let me put it this way. Doraisa, human blood is not forbidden at all, actually. And it's very interesting. So Doraisa, I can drink a cup of human blood. Not only mine, anyone else's blood as well. Now, as you would expect, Midrabanan, the consumption of human blood is forbidden, if for no other reason than Marisayan, people don't know what you're eating. So as a result, when it comes to your own blood, we have an interesting distinction. And that is, let's say your gums, for example, until it leaves your mouth, it's permitted. So if my gums are bleeding, I'm allowed to, if I rinse, I'm allowed to swallow some blood. I don't have to worry about the blood that I swallow. But the Gemara gives an example. If I chew a piece of bread, and whatever it is, my teeth aren't in good shape, so there's a blood spot on the bread, I got to cut it away. I'm not allowed to eat that, because once it's separated. So this would be a similar type of problem. And that is, once it's, in other words, if it's clearly apparent that it's come out of your body and you put it back in, that would be mutter, because it really didn't separate from your body. But if, for example, you already had a blood stain on the outside of your head, not the place of puncture, so this could have been blood from anywhere, so then you would not be allowed to lick it. Okay, so that would be the chiluf, because since you're not dealing with a Torah law, you're only dealing with Maariv Zion, so under any circumstances where it's absolutely clear that it's coming from your puncture wounds, it would not be the issue of blood. Yeah.
So on Shabbos, I guess the structure of the tefillah is a praise, request, and
Well, but Shabbos, there's no request.
So the question is, like, it still seems like there is, because that's a purifying part.
That's correct. That's correct.
So what's the difference between, like, those requests on Shabbos as opposed to...
The issue, I'm going to have to leave in a moment, but I'll say, I want to talk more about this, Biarichas. The issue of asking requests on Shabbos is very, very complicated issue. You'd be very surprised how complicated. On one hand, we say, don't ask for requests on Shabbos. Right, that's the normal rule. On the other hand, you go line by line through tefillah, through benching. You know, you could make a list of 100 things you're asking Hashem for. Now, one of the classic answers they give is also not such a great answer. They get, well, you're not allowed to ask for physical requests, because that's gashmias, but you can ask for spiritual requests. I can ask Hashem, purify my heart, enlighten my mind in Torah. That's a good teretz. On the other hand, when you go to benching, a lot of the stuff you ask for in benching are not just spiritual. You ask Hashem for parnasa. You ask Hashem for physical things. And if you're going to answer, well, yes, but that's because all physical needs lead to spiritual needs. Well, okay, good. That's okay. But once you say that, then ask for everything. You know, give me parnasa so I can learn. Give me help, right? So it's a very, very difficult... Because if you're going to collapse the idea that all gashmias leads to ruchnias, then you no longer have any rule to say what should be usher on Shabbos. So it's a very, very good question, but I would say at least for tefillah, the answer that is given is that when you ask for ruchnias, since Shabbos is about, what is Shabbos? Shabbos is the day of relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So it's very appropriate on Shabbos to ask Hashem to help me have a deep relationship with you. But I'm going to leave open the kasha about benching, because benching is a difficult one. Because benching, we are absolutely asking for gashmias tzurachim, and that seems to be inconsistent. Now, some achronim have a very simple mahalach. They actually say the prohibition of asking for needs on Shabbos only refers to your private petitions. In other words, whatever is part of the standard tefillah is okay. It only refers to, you don't ask for your needs, because it may make you sad as you get preoccupied. We don't want to take away your joy. And therefore, I think the Vilna Gaon says it basically. The Vilna Gaon's approach is, anything that is in the Nusach Kavua of Tefillah has no problem on Shabbos. And, by the way, that's interesting. This is why the Minhag HaGra, maybe you've met people that follow this, is they do not say the harachamans, because benching actually ends with Leolam al Yechasreinu. Those are the four blessings of Birchas HaMazon. And then we ask Hashem for a bunch of requests in a very short form, harachama. So the Minhag HaGra is not to say them on Shabbos, because since that's not part of the Nusach Kavua of benching, it would be a violation of asking for needs. So what's in the benching is the Nusach Kavua. Harachman is not called a Nusach. Now, some Talmidim of the Grod don't say Harachman even during the week, because they say it's not part of benching. But some, even who say it during the week, are not going to say it on Shabbos. So we have a lot of chilukim here. We have a chiluk between Ruchnias and Gashmias, and we have a chiluk between Nusach Kavua and not Nusach Kavua. Some are machaluk between asking things for the Sibor versus asking things for the Yachid, which is Azer. And to make it more complicated, some say that Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are different than all the other Yomim Tovim, because since we're judged on those days, we are allowed on those days, even if we're not allowed on other days. So it's a complicated mixed thing, and we'll talk about it some more. Yeah.
Is it worse to leave early from davening or to show up late?
That reminds. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it kind of depends. How early is early? How late is late? It's hard to answer it in the abstract. It's hard to say. I think leaving early would normally be worse a little bit, because number one, there are many kaddishes at the end, and leaving early seems to have a bit more of a disrespect to our kaddish worker. Than coming late. A person comes late, they oversleep or something. But leaving early implies that even when I'm davening, I'm not really interested in it. So I think the disdain that is being expressed might be greater when you're in shul and you leave than if it took you a while to get here. Yeah.
Is Can you explain how kosher cheese is possible? At least, like, for the modern era, given that rennet comes from a cow?
Yes, yes. A very excellent, very, very excellent question. And indeed, it's a, you know, rennet is the stomach lining of a of cattle. And therefore, all cheese is made, or was made. Today they have artificial rennet,
right.
Indeed. But certainly in the time of Chazal, it was made with cow lining, and that's the acidity that causes the congealing of the cheese. The basic idea is that we were relying on the principle of nullification in 60, because generally speaking, there was 60 times the volume of milk corresponding to the rennet, which is only a small.
But you can't do that ahead of time. It's only good to get it.
That's a good question. Is how are they allowed to make cheese there? The question of ein mevatlim iser lechatchila. Oh, so the answer is this. Yeah. So here's the answer. The answer is, No, this question was asked 100%. The answer is that the iser of nullification, deliberate nullification, was only when something was a prohibited substance, like treif, that you put into kosher. But since meat and milk, the milk is permitted and the meat is permitted, meaning it's, in other words, they only become forbidden in combination.
Rabbinically there, because you aren't cooking it.
No, I understand, but even under Torah law, in other words, milk is permitted separately, right. And meat is permitted separately. So when you mix the cheese with the rennet, mm-hmm. So you're not taking a forbidden substance and putting it into a prohibited, you're taking a permitted and a permitted, and since it never became prohibited because of the 60, so that would be permitted. The only question is, I'm trying to think now, because this raises a real question, so according to that, why can't I pour a little milk into a meat soup as long as I have 60 times, and that absolutely is usher. So I would have to go back and check. I remember the answer that the post can give, is that, that's why by treif cheese it doesn't work. If you use rennet from an animal that wasn't shechted, you can't rely on 60.
I know, that's why I got
right,
sucked,
right. But when it's kosher rennet, a slaughtered animal, so since the rennet is inherently kosher, and the milk is inherently kosher, so you're allowed to do nullification even deliberately. But let me double check, because according to that reasoning, that would apply identically to putting some milk in a meat soup if you have 60, which you clearly are not allowed to do. Of course, that might be different, because there, since there's actual cooking, you're dealing with a biblical prohibition. Cheese making at most would be a rabbinic prohibition. Let me check it. It is a good question. Okay, I got it wrong. Anyway, have a good week. We'll see you.